From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Sumner Redstone, family patriarch and indomitable head of Viacom and CBS for so long, built a giant media empire and then hung on and on. Now, 92, confined to his home in Beverly Hills, his wishes are still steering a huge swath of American media amid lawsuits, family conflicts, business battles. And meanwhile, the media itself is changing dramatically. This hour On Point, a fiery family story and the future of media. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you followed the raging battles around Viacom, CBS? Who owns the media you consume? And why might it matter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the first introduction of President Obama's brand new Supreme Court nominee, Judge Merrick Garland. But first to Viacom, CBS, and the Redstone family feud. You may not know all they own, but you probably know the shows that those huge media properties put out. Daily Show was Jon Stewart, now Trevor Noah on Comedy Central, part of this empire. Here was Trevor Noah, March 10th, introducing one of the show's hottest topics of this year.
You know, guys, we've gotten to know Donald Trump so well over the past year. I mean, well, at this point, he's practically a member of the family, specifically the uncle who hits on your wife at funerals.
From this empire, the way we understand politics, maybe a little bit of it the way we understand war. Here from Paramount, another piece of the media empire, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. One of the big releases this spring about journalist Kim Baker, played by Tina Fey, gets an assignment to Afghanistan. Here from the trailer.
Miss Baker, this is an extreme environment.
Grenade, down, down!
I've seen people with actual experience make bad decisions here.
You should let me interview you.
But I do not know you. How can we get to know each other?
All part of one big, big, big and sprawling media conglomerate. Lots of companies in there. And here, the man himself, the patriarch, Sumner Redstone, now 92. Back in 2000, he talked with the Archive for American Television about his philosophy of success.
Success is not built on success. It's built on failure, frustration, sometimes even calamity, in how we deal with it.
There has been plenty of success and its opposite and all kinds of complications in a big family feud story about the future of a major chunk of American media real estate. We want to look at it. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Meg James, corporate media reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Meg James, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, thank you.
And from Los Angeles, Lucas Shaw joins us, media reporter for Bloomberg Business. Lucas, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you just paint the picture for a second of the scope of this media empire when you put it all together? You've got this company, National Amusement, started out as a cinema or theater chain. They've got this great stake in Viacom and CBS, and under those umbrellas, for people who don't have any sense of the breadth of what's in there. Give us a sense, Lucas, of what falls under that terrain.
Sure. So Viacom owns a number of cable networks, more than a dozen, MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, BET, VH1, TV Land, so on and so forth. And a number of those cable networks also operate outside of the U.S. So MTV, Nickelodeon, those are in more than 100 countries worldwide with kind of different permutations.
Yep.
Viacom also owns Paramount Pictures, which, as you mentioned with that movie, is one of the six major movie studios and one of the oldest movie studios, dates back to the early 20th century. CBS, on the other hand, owns CBS Broadcast Network, which is the most watched TV network in the U.S. It also owns Showtime, which is a premium cable network, kind of the second banana to HBO. It owns Simon & Schuster, the book publisher. And it also owns, for now, a bunch of radio stations under CBS Radio, though they actually said yesterday that they're going to explore selling those stations.
And Meg James, what percentage of the ownership of all of that goes back to this one extended family?
80% of the ownership of both CBS and separately Viacom are controlled by the Redstone family, right now controlled by Sumner.
And what is at the heart of the feud that keeps showing up? I mean, it's had many iterations now, and the news just keeps coming. But what is at the heart of the unsettled business here, Meg?
Oh, Tom, it's such a rich and messy story. At the heart, we're talking about a battle for control of not only this major media empire, but also the legacy of the Redstone family. There's ownership issues. Who's going to take over the media companies on that day when Sumner, you know, passes? But also, I think there's been little battles brewing inside of the companies, alliances formed, and at the heart of it, there's also been a continuing struggle between Shari Redstone and her father Sumner, whom, as you said, is now 92 and is in failing health.
Shari, his daughter, who's a key player in all this. I mean, it's amazing, Meg, when people sit around, they're watching, you know, The Big Bang Theory or 60 Minutes or the Super Bowl or the Daily Show or on and on and on. You don't often think of this going back to one almost nuclear, really, family here. Their ownership, their vision, and these days, or lately certainly, their conflicts.
Yes, that's right. Sumner acquired Viacom in 1987 in a hostile takeover, and there's been so much about Sumner's life that has been hostile with different of his lieutenants, his corporate lieutenants, with his daughter, with his son. The power struggles have gone on for decades and, you know, have sort of raged again in the last few months here in his, you know, final months.
Lucas, bring us up to speed then on where the corporate battles have been hottest lately within this Viacom, CBS, National Amusements, Redstone family empire.
It's all been localized in Viacom. Les Moonves, who runs CBS, has inspired the confidence of most shareholders and investors. Shari, whom you mentioned, has expressed her support for him. Whereas at Viacom, there are a lot of questions about Philippe Daumont, who's been the CEO of Viacom for about a decade now. He's a longtime confidant of Sumner Redstone, former family lawyer or corporate lawyer. But because of Viacom's struggles over the past several years, the stock has been in decline. Viewership of its main networks has been in decline. There have been some shareholders who've been agitating for change and who've expressed displeasure at how much the top executives at Viacom have been paid, but they have no ability to exercise any influence or bring about any change because of the Redstone family's control over the empire.
This all comes at a time when many, many angles of media are under challenge because of the internet coming in and disrupting so much. Television very acutely under that kind of pressure. And so there's a magnifying glass on here, Lucas, on how Viacom performs.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who watches Netflix or YouTube, these are some of the companies that have come around and really unsettled the TV business. So much of viewership has moved online and on demand. This all started actually kind of with the DVR and with the VCR before it, and the ability to kind of what's called time shift or watch shows after they appear on television, because you make the most from advertising if people watch it live. But as fewer and fewer people watch live television, that has really challenged all of these big media companies, and Viacom has been one of the most affected because it owns all these networks that are popular among young viewers who are maybe spending more time on Snapchat or YouTube or just surfing the web on their phone.
So you've got some of the youngest Americans who are driving the future of media, channels?
Of a company and run by a 92-year-old.
Run by a 92-year-old. And that 92-year-old, Meg James, his very health and I guess at this point, from the legal documents that have come out, his competence is a big issue. And who's looking after him?
Well, that's a very big question. And in fact, last month, a judge here in Los Angeles raised very questions about who actually is taking care of Sumner. He, you know, because he is so wealthy, he has a round-the-clock team of, I think, 9 nurses, not, you know, at all times, but around the clock, caring to it for his wishes. But Sumner, last fall, decided that Philippe Daumont, the CEO of Viacom, should be his healthcare proxy in case anything should happen. And the judge said, wait a minute, you know, this guy, Daumont, he's in New York. He's trying to run Viacom. He's got enough problems on the plate. And you know, it should caring for this 92-year-old man in Los Angeles be one of his problems? And then the judge also raised questions about, you know, why not a daughter or a family member? Why did Sumner appoint, you know, his lieutenant at Viacom to be the man who, you know, ultimately could make very important decisions about Sumner's life or death?
What's the answer to that question? Why bring on the executive chairman of your company instead of your family to look over your health?
Well, like everything with the Redstone family, it's very combative, messy, and complicated. Sumner, for the last few years, until last fall, was surrounded by two longtime female companions who basically, and depending on whom you talk to in the story, isolated Shari Redstone, who over the years has had a turbulent relationship with her father. Suddenly, last fall, Sumner forces out these two women, and one of them came back to sue the state and basically say that Sumner's incompetent and the decision that he made to throw her out of his home and his life was not a decision that he would have made if he had been in a sound mind.
I mean, I think I read that, that she had been heir to a $20 million mansion that they were living in Beverly Hills, so she, and more. So there's a stake
in
that.
Oh, yes, and much more, and much more. In fact, Shari Redstone, in a separate court document, contends that the former female companion, Manuela Herzer, had received over $70 million from her father over the past few years and was in line to receive another $50 million, as well as Sumner's hilltop mansion in Beverly Park.
Lucas, there's family drama here. There's an element of soap opera for outsiders looking in, of course. There's a ton of money. But this is also a huge piece of American media that is in play as the struggle over who's going to control what and what visions are made manifest plays out.
Yeah, I mean, the court case that's been ongoing doesn't have a direct effect on Viacom or CBS or National Amusements. However, if the court were to find that Sumner Redstone was incapacitated, was not in his right mind when he made this decision, it would cause kind of an examination of whether he should be kind of exercising control over his voting shares in these companies.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the family feud, battle royal over media giant Viacom and more, the family empire that owns everything from Comedy Central to CBS, and how its fight may shape a big corner of American media. Later in this hour, we look at President Obama's new Supreme Court nominee. But you can join us on this epic media family battle. Do you know the Redstone family story, the drama, the lawsuits, the power plays? Have you seen how family business succession battles play out, maybe even in your family? Does it change the way you see the media to see how at least this part of it, big part, is owned and governed? Lucas Shaw is with us from Bloomberg Business. Meg James from the Los Angeles Times. They're both in L.A. New executive chairman of Viacom. And, of course, everything's been fought over here. But Philippe Daman spoke in November at Variety's Big Data Summit in Los Angeles, looking to position Viacom as leaning forward, leaning into a new era in media.
This is probably the most exciting creative time that I've seen in the 3 decades I've been involved with Viacom. In many parts of the world, we are completely skipping the television side and going straight to smartphones. We're going to have the biggest mobile video production facility in the media space.
We're right out on the frontier, but Viacom stock has really suffered as people worry and wonder about that, and they have lots of competition, young viewers and listeners. But where do they go? S&P's global market intelligence Tuna Amobi told Reuters in February that investors were getting impatient with Viacom and the pressure was on Chairman Philippe Daman.
This is the second year of major underperformance. I would say that he probably, you know, buys in at least, you know, another year to turn things around in a hurry. And after that, I think you're going to start to see investors' patience, you know, start to, you know, wear thin.
The patriarch is 92 at this point. His daughter, Shari Redstone, many people see her as still circling, looking to somehow come in and ultimately take control here. She talked with Bloomberg Business back in 2011 just to get a sense of how she thinks, she talks. This is a Boston area born and bred, like her father. Here she's talking about the movie-going experience and what's changing there. That's the part of the business she came up in.
I think it's really unclear that the overall revenue for any given movie is increased by shortening the windows and putting it into these alternative distribution platforms. There's always time to get there. But I think if we don't protect that window and protect the value that's being created by having a movie on the screen where it's meant to be seen, by maximizing the box office revenue, ultimately all the subsequent revenue streams will be diminished.
Shari Redstone. Meg James, it took her a long time to really come into the family business in a big way. Is there an expectation that at some point she might be the one, the real successor to Sumner, her father?
Well, I think that's very possible. She's a very accomplished woman. She started out as a lawyer. She currently runs a small investment firm that's looking at new media. She's a very smart woman. The only sort of hitch to that is that she's currently having a side struggle, I would say, with Philippe Dumont, who runs Viacom. Sherry made it very clear when Philippe was elevated to replace her father as executive chairman of Viacom that she did not want to see Philippe in that role. And everyone, including her father, voted for Philippe. So there is, you know, there is some question about, you know, how fully she will be allowed to, you know, control things at Viacom. On the other hand, at CBS, she has a quite lovely relationship with the head of CBS. So the problems are really, as Lucas pointed out earlier, concentrated in Viacom.
I mean, nobody lives forever. This gets passed on. What's the value of the Redstone family holdings here now? Do you have a current sense of that, Meg?
Well, the value, their economic stake in Viacom is considerably less than their voting shares. So I think we're probably talking in about $8 billion, maybe a little bit more. Their voting shares do control the vote. And so they have this outsized control of the media companies by controlling the 80% of the voting shares of these two media companies. The other sort of complication is that Sumner once famously said that he's controlling things now and he will control things after he dies. And sure enough, he has put in place a trust, a 7-member trust that will oversee what happens to his shares in National Amusements. And Sherry is one of the trustees, but so is Dumont, the CEO of Viacom. So this sort of friction that we're seeing might continue in the years to come and sort of delay a prompt resolution of what happens to the media empire.
What is this really about? It's fascinating to see great family conglomerates and fortunes. I mean, is it an Oedipal thing about power and control? Is it explicitly different visions of how media ought to go forward? What, Meg?
I think it's all of that. I think that Sherry and her father have long disagreed over the way the company should be run. Sumner's looked at Viacom as his personal, you know, fiefdom. He has the voting control, so he has every, you know, reason to do that. And they've struggled in the past over whether or not to expand their theater business, their movie theater business, whether or not Philippe should be in power at Viacom. And I think at the end of the day, you know, Sherry loves her father very much, and it's been quite difficult for her to sort of sit by to see Viacom deteriorate over the last few years. And I think that's driving some of the current tension that we're seeing as well.
She has said on more than one occasion, I think, that she has 80% of her father's brains, 90% of his passion, and 100% of his obsessive nature. And that's a pretty strong nature in Sumner Redstone. Luke Shaw, is it weird in the business world to see such a gigantic conglomerate so wrapped around one family's struggles? Or is this a lot of what goes on in the American corporate world, and we just don't get such a view into it very often?
It's not unusual for there to be a family that exercises kind of unilateral control over a large company. If you look at what was News Corp is now 21st Century Fox, the Murdoch family runs that company. I don't think they have quite as much of the voting stock as the Redstones do in Viacom and CBS. But Rupert Murdoch, who kind of created News Corp and then, like Sumner Redstone, kind of amassed this sprawling media empire, recently had a pretty seamless transition where he handed over control of Fox to his two sons, one of whom is CEO, the other of whom is a chairman. And there are other examples where families exercise control. This has just been kind of the sexiest saga, if you will, because of these outsized personalities in Sumner Redstone and his daughter, because of the decline at Viacom, and because of kind of Redstone's reputation for confrontation.
Meg, give us a sense over the years, the series, kind of dramatic series of divorces and lawsuits and battles that have marked this family's relationship, governance, the works.
Oh, man, Tom, you could go back to the 1960s. I think Sumner was one of the original theater owners that sued the Hollywood movie studios about the way they parceled out films to the various theaters. You know, his fight for Paramount in 1994 was a huge, huge battle with Barry Diller and John Malone, who, you know, then were behind the QVC home shopping network. Sumner ultimately prevailed, coming away with his prize, Paramount Pictures, for about $10 billion, which analysts thought at the time was way overvalued. And that's one of the things that was very telling in the last few weeks. Shortly after Philippe Dumont took over the reins totally at Viacom, they announced that they're going to put a piece of Paramount Pictures, this legendary movie studio, up for sale. And maybe some investors, maybe Chinese interests, will come in and buy a piece of this movie studio that Sumner loved. Paramount was his probably most prized possession beyond all of Viacom. And so it really signals that we're starting to see the changes here.
You've got marital disputes and disputes within the family as well over who's got what. I mean, not just there's a daughter, there's a son, there's nephews who have come in here. There was an epic divorce case, all of which went directly to, one way or another, to the company and his fortune.
Indeed. In fact, the Sumner's divorce from his first wife, Phyllis, they were married for I think, 50-some years. Part of the agreement, the divorce agreement, allowed Sherry Redstone, the daughter, to be named the chair of Viacom and CBS. And so
Phyllis fight for that? Is that what you're saying there? Her mother wanted her to be?
That appears to be the case. And you know, actually, that was also one of the provisions of a Rupert Murdoch divorce many years ago. So you have the mother saying, you know, my daughter should be involved. And that, I think, is also one of perhaps, you know, I obviously can't speak for Sherry Redstone, but I'm sure it's very frustrating for her that her father in some ways has sort of steamrolled over her wishes and her desire to be included. And we're seeing some of that sort of frustration playing out now.
Her brother eventually sold his share of the business. That much was settled. John in Shenandoah, Iowa. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. If Viacom is doing so poorly, would it be reasonable for one of the other larger mass media corporations like Walt Disney or 21st Century to try a hostile takeover of Viacom?
Lucas, what do you say? Thanks, John. Lucas?
There's been a tremendous amount of kind of rumor, speculation about mergers, acquisitions. Some people have suggested that they should put CBS and Viacom back together, which both Philippe Dumont and Les Moonves have rejected. I think there may be some interest in Viacom. As Meg said, there's a piece of Paramount Pictures that's up for sale right now, and Philippe has said he wants to try and close that deal in the next few months. What any large media company would have to consider when buying Viacom, though, is do they want to buy a number of cable networks. That is one asset in media that has probably depreciated a bit over the past few years. So it may not be that appealing as we move into this era of online streaming.
And describe, I mean, you make it clear, I guess, in a way with your last phrase there, but why cable company values have diminished? What's the dynamic that's pushing them down?
Live viewership of cable networks has decreased. And at the same time, you have these large pay TV companies, your Comcast, your Time Warner Cable, the people you buy cable from, who are experimenting with what's called skinny bundles, which are smaller packages of cable channels. So they take you from having to pay for a 200 or 400 channel package to just 20 to 50. So all these cable channels with shrinking viewership may get squeezed out in this scenario, which is causing a lot of investors to worry about the future of companies like Viacom that are almost entirely dependent on cable TV networks for their annual profits.
And Meg, so much viewing is going from the big old TV screens. There are plenty of them out there still, but viewing and value going to the telephone, the smartphone screen. I mean, you've got this deal you reported on not long ago between Viacom and Snapchat. And Snapchat, you know, with those quick little videos that people share, privately held, valued at $16 billion, more than Viacom's $13 billion market capitalization at this point. Maybe could one of these new world companies end up buying all or part of Viacom?
Well, conceivably, yes. I mean, there are a lot of tech companies, there's a lot of foreign interests that would have the money to do it. But again, because the vote is wrapped up in the Redstone family and this trust, that, you know, shaking the company out, having the trustees vote, yes, we want to put the company on the block, might take, you know, a few months to, or maybe even longer to play out. So I think the only – well, not the only thing, but one of the things holding it up right now is that while the Redstone family controls 80%, what Sumner wants is still going to be, you know, what rules at the end of the day.
Lucas, does the market or shareholders, have they expressed a preference somehow whether it should ultimately be family control here or just try and – get out of all that? I don't know how you do that, but do they want Sherry at the top or a corporate leader, or can you really disentangle these? I mean, after all, the guy who's now the executive chairman is so close to Sumner. Maybe, as he once said, as Meg says, maybe his control goes on even at his age, even beyond.
Yeah, there have been a few vocal shareholders who've asked for a regime change, for Philippe to step down or take a different position. But they're kind of the general market has not expressed a preference. I think what they all really want is just some evidence of a clear strategy at the company. There's been a feeling of creative drift for the past several years. They want to know what the leadership team at Viacom is doing to turn the company around. And if they see a clear strategy, they'll be happy. And what all these investors care about, what all the analysts care about, is that the company is delivering a return. And if it does that, you know, it keeps everyone happy. And in Sherry's case, one of the reasons she has a better relationship right now with Les Moonves than Philippe is because Les has done a better job running the company.
And do we know anything, Meg, about her actual relationship at this point with her father, Sumner, where, you know, ultimately roads still lead back there?
That's a very good question, Tom. It appears that while Sumner was surrounded by his female companions, Sherry was very isolated and not even, you know, there's some dispute over whether or not she was even allowed into his house. After Sumner expelled these female companions, Sherry reunited with her father. Her camp, you know, counted 39 times that she and her family visited Sumner between I guess the end of October and Christmas, and which is actually a good thing because, you know, for 2 years I think Sherry and her father were having more struggles, and it's good that, you know, perhaps the family can reunite. It's going to be interesting too because the judge has set a trial in May, and I think we're going to learn more about just, you know, Sumner's condition, you know, the family relationship, and, you know, the eventually control of this media empire.
So much American media writing on this. How do you see it? Is this ultimately a story about corporate strategy and management, Meg, or is it ultimately a family saga?
I think ultimately it is a family saga, and I think that Sherry Redstone and Sumner Redstone want their place, you know, in history to be, you know, as esteemed as it perhaps should be, and that's one of the problems with Viacom struggling operationally. Now, you know, you have investors who always trusted, you know, Sumner to the nth degree, now questioning the strategy. And then you also have the issue of, you know, this 92-year-old man who is controlling a media company that's trying desperately to appeal to, you know, people in their teens and kids on Nickelodeon. And so the story, you know, takes many shapes and forms.
Well, their properties are certainly all over the place. Whether you know it or not, you are watching and listening and being entertained and watching the sports and much more that comes through Viacom. How long do they have, Lucas, to settle this? Or can this just be a family saga in perpetuity?
Well, the second largest shareholder, Mario Gabelli, has said that Philippe has 6 to 12 months to demonstrate that he's turning things around. But as we've discussed throughout this, it really comes down to what happens with Sumner Redstone and the family trust. You know, Sumner is sicker now, it would appear, than he's ever been. And so we may have some resolution when something happens to him.
Well, we will be watching in a more informed way as this amazing saga rolls ahead and a big, big piece of American media's fate gets ultimately determined, and maybe some serious, difficult family relations along with it. Meg James at the Los Angeles Times, corporate media reporter there. Great to have you with us today, Meg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lucas Shaw, media reporter for Bloomberg Business. Lucas, thanks for joining us from L.A.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, President Obama names his nominee for the United States Supreme Court. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This morning in the Rose Garden, President Obama introduced Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, as his nominee to fill the embattled seat on the U.S. Supreme Court left vacant with the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Garland is 63 years old, a graduate of Harvard Law School. Before becoming a judge, he was a prosecutor, supervised the Justice Department investigations into the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing and into Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. Republicans, of course, have vowed to block the nomination and say they will not hold hearings. We're looking at the new nominee and what he's up against, what the president is up against in pushing his nomination. This morning in the Rose Garden, President Obama announced the nominee.
Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
A nominee, said the president, admired on all sides.
I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence. These qualities and his long commitment to public service have earned him the respect and admiration of leaders from both sides of the aisle.
And there in the Rose Garden, Judge Merrick Garland himself, who will face who knows what as this nomination is pushed, talking about his view on life and the law.
Fidelity to the Constitution and the law has been the cornerstone of my professional life. And it is the hallmark of the kind of judge I have tried to be for the past 18 years. If the Senate sees fit to confirm me to the position for which I have been nominated today, I promise to continue on that course.
63-year-old Merrick Garland, now the nominee, in the Rose Garden at the White House this morning. And you can hear very clearly the emotion in his voice over this moment and maybe what may lie ahead with this nomination. To look at this man, moment, and the path ahead with us from San Francisco, Jeffrey Rosen, professor at George Washington Law School, contributing editor at The Atlantic, president, CEO of the National Constitution Center, big nonprofit, nonpartisan outfit devoted to explaining the U.S. Constitution and what it represents. His forthcoming book is Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
And with us from Washington, Randy Barnett, professor at Georgetown Law School, director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's got a new book coming out next month, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Randy Barnett, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be back again, Tom.
Jeffrey Rosen, your first reaction to the president's choice of nominee, Merrick Garland.
What a remarkable ceremony it was. President Obama so clearly convinced that he had picked someone who was the embodiment of a bipartisan pick who in the past had been admired by Republicans and Democrats alike, so striking that he said when he asked Republicans which judge would be their ideal in the past, it would be Merrick Garland. And then, as you mentioned, the emotion in Merrick Garland's voice was so palpable, and also the profundity of his experience in law enforcement and the way it affected him. He talked about the Oklahoma City experience, where he was so scrupulous to demand subpoenas for evidence, even stuff that people were volunteering to turn over voluntarily. And he talked, both he and Obama really said, it's so important in these polarized times for the judges and courts to appear to be above partisan politics. It was just remarkable. But, of course, there was such a poignancy to the situation because Judge Garland, so supremely well qualified for appointment, recognizing the battles that lie ahead, President Obama calling on the Senate at least to give him a fair hearing. It really was a high moment of constitutional drama.
Here was the president saying, look, I've talked to everybody to try and get a nominee who would be right, the president in the Rose Garden.
I've sought the advice of Republican and Democratic members of Congress. We've reached out to every member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, to constitutional scholars, to advocacy groups, to bar associations representing an array of interests and opinions from all across the spectrum.
Randy Barnett, we'll look at the way ahead and what it will or won't be, what it should or shouldn't be. But what about the man himself, the judge, the legal, constitutional thinker, Merrick Garland? How do you see him?
Well, this is probably the most personal Supreme Court nominee I've ever had to watch since he and I were classmates at Harvard Law School together.
Wow.
He and I, not just classmates, we were in the same section of our first year class, and that means back in that day you took every single class with the same people, and so he really stood out as a classmate. We had 140 people in a section, and I didn't remember all of them, but no one forgot Merrick Garland. He was what law school students call a gunner in the class. He was the one that constantly spoke and challenged, but he didn't just speak to answer the questions. He actually spoke to challenge the professors, and so all of us admired him, and in some respects, we looked up to him as somebody who, you know, we might try to emulate as fellow law students.
Where would you place him in the spectrum of justices interpreting the Constitution today? Left, right, center, amalgam, what?
Well, look, I think there's two basic camps about the Constitution. One that believes in the limits that the federal government is placed under by the Constitution, is what I call in my book the Republican Constitution. The other believes in more democratic majoritarian rule. And I think, although he's an extremely moderate, intelligent, and skillful jurist, he is on the other side of me from this. He would be somebody who would be supporting what would be considered to be the left side of the court as it's currently constituted. It would be, his appointment would represent a major change in the direction that the court currently has with the vacancy of Justice Scalia.
Jeffrey Rosen, give us your view on those stripes, how they sit on Merrick Garland.
I should say that, like Randy, I've known Merrick Garland for many years and admire him for the same reasons that Randy does, because of his intelligence and moderation and fair-mindedness. But as Randy suggests, the splits on the court are sort of cross-cutting. So there's no doubt that Merrick Garland would be much more sympathetic to federal power than both Randy and some of the more libertarian justices. He's quite deferential to the government, and in that sense, he's an acolyte of judicial restraint. He believes, as he said in his Rose Garden statement, the judges should interpret the law, not make it. That's a mantra that we've heard from Republican nominees for a long time. But he's also probably more sympathetic to law enforcement than some more libertarian judges on both the left and the right. His entire career was as a prosecutor. He talked about his experience prosecuting gangs as having shaped his life, like Justice Stephen Breyer, who sometimes votes with the conservative justices on criminal justice issues. You could well imagine Merrick Garland deferring to the government in criminal cases. So although Randy is ultimately correct that on the great social issues that are transfixing the country and the court, from marriage equality, affirmative action, voting rights, campaign finance, these are all cases where Merrick Garland, like any Democratic nominee, would tip the balance in replacing Justice Scalia. On the scale of Democratic nominees, this is one of the more moderate ones, which is why groups like the pro-choice groups have already said we need to hear more about his views on these matters. This is not a liberal ideologue by any chance. He actually is what President Obama presented him as, an open-minded, fair-minded, bipartisan, neutral judge.
But when you step back and look at the court, Antonin Scalia is the one who fate has taken off the bench at this point. We've seen decades of the Supreme Court moving in a more conservative direction. Would Merrick Garland be the major change in that? Would he reorient the court? Randy Barnett suggests he would, even with that moderation.
I think that he would, because although on criminal justice issues he may be deferential to the government, those are issues where liberal and conservative justices already have unusual alliances, and many of those cases are unanimous. There are no William Brennan-like judges on the court, the justice for whom Merrick Garland clerked, who are determined to, you know, sort of let out criminals on technicalities in a caricatured view. The court is deeply divided on the issues I mentioned and others, and these are ones where any Democratic nominee is likely to shift the balance, so that's why the seat is so consequential. I'm trying to think of any area in which Merrick Garland would deviate from shifting the balance. And I think on racial equality and voting rights, which he's been devoted to as both before and after he joined the D.C. Circuit, campaign finance, abortion, gay marriage. These are all cases where he would be on the opposite side of Justice Scalia and would indeed reorient the court.
Randy Barnett, let me get your view on that. We'll come to process again. The will he or won't he, should he or shouldn't he be confirmed or even heard. But in terms of substance, what would you anticipate on the social or substantial front in let's say, some decades, perhaps, of a Justice Merrick Garland and his impact?
Well, Jeff and I are in pretty total agreement about the likely impact that Judge Garland would have on the court. I just want to point out one other issue, which mm-hmm. is gun rights in the Second Amendment. In the lower court in the D.C. Circuit invalidated the D.C. gun ban as unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. That is what was upheld. That lower court ruling is what was upheld in the Heller case. And Judge Garland was among the judges on the D.C. Circuit who voted to rehear that argument en banc, in other words, to reverse the lower court decision invalidating the law.
Which puts him on the side then of gun control or against
yes.
it with that ruling?
Well, not the policy question, but puts him on the side of the fact that the Second Amendment does not protect an individual right mm-hmm. such that the D.C. gun ban violated it. He mm-hmm. was on the other side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the D.C. Circuit voted not to hear that case again. And then it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed the lower court. Justice Scalia's opinion affirmed the lower court. So that's a major difference that you can expect advocates who would oppose Judge
from
Garland.
From Scalia, the hunter, to Garland, the Heller impact here.
Right. But if I could take this opportunity to say, I do think I support the Republicans' refusal to consider any nominee, and the very fact that Judge Garland is such a highly qualified and moderate and reasonable nominee only underscores the principled nature of that opposition. That is, if he had been somebody who was more objectionable, then that would mean that the argument of principle that they should not be considering someone in an election year would be more partisan. But because he is so reasonable, it underscores the principled nature of the opposition to hearing any or considering any nominee, no matter how reasonable they are.
What is that principle? The president's duly elected twice. The Constitution says, nominate someone to the high court. He's done it. What's the principled objection?
Yes, the principle is that the president, a lame duck president, is going to be making an appointment that's going to be lasting decades and move the direction of the court in the ways that Jeff and I both agree it will be moved.
What difference does the point he's at in his tenure make in terms of his obligation to nominate?
Because we are in the middle of an election.
So what? He was elected in an election.
Well, so were the Republicans in Congress. In the Senate, they were elected as well.
Yeah, but they have their job, and he has his, right? He's to nominate, they're to consider.
And their job is to refuse or to grant their consent as they wish for the reasons that they wish to mm-hmm. refuse and grant their consent. They're under no obligation to do anything other than to consent or not consent. And they as everybody knows, they consent all the time. They refuse to consent all the time by not taking up things, like not taking up House bills, not taking up treaties. That's how they operate. So they have every right to do. The president had every right to nominate. They have every right to refuse. And the principal reason is that this is now going to be the matter. The decision of what the direction of the future Supreme Court is going to be is now going to be a matter of a national election to be settled within months. And it's on the basis of that election that this nomination and that this seat should be filled.
But there was already a national election. In 2012, Barack Obama won it.
And in 2014, the Republicans took control of the Senate. There's now a new election coming up. We're talking about the future that extends well beyond Barack Obama's presidency. And the Republicans in the Senate are entitled to say that decision should be made by the people in the next election.
Yeah, nearly all of course, Supreme Court additions to the bench go far beyond the president who supported them. Jeffrey Rosen, what about this issue of should or shouldn't the nominee be taken up and Randy Barnett's principle as described here?
Well, let me just talk about it historically and as neutrally as I can. In my riveting forthcoming book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet,
riveting.
I tell a story. It's coming out on June 1st, which is the 100th anniversary of Brandeis's confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a significant date because Brandeis was nominated on January 28th, 1916, and confirmed 125 days later on June 1st. That was the longest that any nominee previously in American history has had to wait. And there is no precedent for anything longer than that. Now, it's true that was a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, and it's true that you have to go back to the 19th century to see long waits when presidents face a Republican Senate. But the bottom line is that although it's true that literally the Senate can do what it likes and the president has done what he views as his constitutional responsibility, President Obama says that if this precedent goes through, it will basically ensure a nuclear explosion of the increasing partisan nature of judicial hearings. And you really set up the possibility that, you know, to take the possibility that the Senate goes Democratic, imagine a Republican won, you could have a lame duck situation where the new Senate, the Democratic Senate, at the beginning of January, in the several weeks before inauguration of the new president, decides to confirm Merrick Garland or any other nominee, and the precedent for that is the midnight judges of the election of 1800, where John Adams literally stays up all night signing judicial commissions in order to pack the bench to deny the seats to Thomas Jefferson. So just as the Constitution doesn't require hearings, but I think we can just say descriptively that there is no precedent for the Senate completely refusing to act before in American history. And if it does this, then all bets are off for the future.
Randy Barnett, you describe President Obama as a lame duck president. How far back would that go then, that description for you? All the way back to 2014? Would it be 2 years of a term that would, if midterms went to the other party, that you would describe as unsuitable for a new nominee?
Well, Tom, as I'm sure you know, Senator Biden, when he was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, gave a lengthy floor speech in which he outlined the principle that Democrats would follow if President Bush had nominated someone, if a vacancy had occurred in the final year of his term and Bush had nominated somebody. He said that Democrats would not take that nomination up. So this is a position the Democrats have held in the past, and there's no question that if the situation were reversed, they would do the exact same thing for the exact same reason.
Well, that is what politicians like to call a hypothetical, but you may be right. The reality of what unfolds here, we will see soon enough, and we're very grateful to the two of you for beginning to introduce us to Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee for the seat vacated with the death of Antonin Scalia. Randy Barnett at Georgetown Law School, author of the forthcoming Our Republican Constitution. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jeffrey Rosen, look for his Louis D. Brandeis American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. A pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.